This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away on jury duty. Coming up, we speak with the Black and openly gay filmmaker Maurice Jamal about his career and urban LGBT television network. But first, Spanish language media in the U.S. Networks like Univision and Telemundo are seeing much higher ratings than some listeners might expect. And the Census Bureau says the Hispanic population has now topped 50 million. Yesterday, President Obama traveled to Puerto Rico not only to connect with the people there, but also political analysts say to help him gain support from Puerto Ricans living and voting for president on the mainland in the U.S. The scope and influence of Hispanics are at issue in a gathering this week of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. To learn more about the impact of Spanish language media, as well as any turn toward Hispanic news by English language media, we're joined on the line by Monica Lozano. She's CEO of America's largest Spanish language newspaper company called Impra Media. It publishes La Opinión in Los Angeles, El Diario La Prensa in New York, as well as a community weekly La Raza in Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Allison. It's nice to be with you.
So, Monica, let's talk a bit about the numbers the Spanish language media are pulling in. Newspapers, TV, radio. It's kind of impressive, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. When you're seeing a decline in overall ratings and readership by English language newspapers and media outlets, Spanish language media is clearly on the upswing. Seen significant growth, double-digit growth, actually, in terms of both viewership and readership in Spanish-language media.
Can you talk to us about some of the things that make Spanish-language media unique?
You have to break it down. So you mentioned in the intro that this is a community of over 50 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very diverse. There isn't one single approach that would be appropriate for the entire community.
Right, so it's not a monolithic.
Exactly, right. And because of that diversity, you actually have greater increase both in the number of outlets as well as I said before, those that are well-established brands like Univision, Impromedia, et cetera, are also seeing growth. I think fundamentally the reason for this is because these outlets provide content that is very unique, deeply connected to the issues of interest to these communities, and have a special relationship. If you look at the mission statements of Spanish language media organizations, it's not just to grow the bottom line. It's not just to serve shareholders. There really is a push to empower a community. Even as the population becomes more diverse, both linguistically and culturally, that affinity, that connection to Spanish language media continues because people see it as almost a partner in their life in a way that they don't typically connect with other media organizations.
Let me jump in for a minute because we were just talking about how the audience is not monolithic. I wonder if there is a thing about the way English language media coverage of issues important to your community drives you insane.
It certainly does. And there has been a lot of effort around working with English language news organizations to better reflect the depth of this community in all of its aspects. You know, unfortunately, if you were to ask people today, you know, tell me about the Mexican-American community in the United States, the first thing people would talk about is, you know, drug trafficking, mm-hmm. and, you know, violence on the border and the problems of Mexico, as opposed to this is the community that has the fastest rate of business startups, that has the fastest rates of college-growing young people. And so there's a tendency to look at, you know, all of the problems and the dysfunction of a community as opposed to those things that I think really define the aspirational nature of Hispanics in America.
Let me ask you about what's happening with Hispanic journalists and technology and social media. Mm-hmm. That's becoming a place, I should say, where there is clearer coverage of your community than you might find in other outlets. Is that right?
Absolutely. And so years ago, everybody talked about the digital divide, and this was of great concern, that you had people who were on the highway and others who were not. Today, that digital divide is disappearing quickly. 60% of all Latinos are online, and within the next 2 years, 80% will be online. Fastest rates of use of social media, both in terms of growth as well as total number of people using social media, And so what you're seeing is the emergence of niche communities online related to areas of interest. It could be Mexican soccer. It could be moms. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying here is that you have, you know, large entities that continue to grow, and you also see the increase of these narrower community-based online sites.
Let me ask you, do you think that Spanish language media is affecting how so-called mainstream media is covering your community?
Oh, absolutely. For example, you mentioned that the president was in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So he does a one-on-one with Univision and talks about everything from the economy to politics to the status of Puerto Rico, et cetera. The fact that the president provides a one-on-one sit-down with a Spanish-language news entity gets the attention of English-language media. There are things that are being discussed in Spanish-language media that I think, you know, clearly are of interest and need to be considered by English-language news organizations. And so I think this, frankly, cross-pollinization that could occur would be very valuable to all of us.
In the brief time we have left, you were just talking about cross-pollinization. Where do you think the future of Spanish language media lies? Will there be kind of a merging of mainstream and Spanish language, or will they continue to be different entities with a different focus?
It's a good question. You know, the fact that 62% of all Latinos are born in the United States, that means that, you know, these young people are growing up here. English will be their first language. They will be connected to their culture and the issues of interest to their parents. But you will begin to see, I think, greater reflection of the Latino community in English language media. And then I think, as I said before, you will see these, you know, customized platforms that speak to Latinos, mm-hmm. that do it in both languages.
Monica, we've got to leave it there. Monica Lozano is the CEO of Imprimedia. It's America's largest Spanish language newspaper company. She was kind enough to join us from Orlando, Florida, where she is attending the National Association of Hispanic Journalists Convention that runs today through Sunday. Monica Lozano, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Allison. I enjoyed it.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Today at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan, workers tested a system that will start cleaning up radioactive water. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, the water has flooded many buildings at the complex, and it has seriously complicated efforts to bring the crisis there to an end.
The utility in Japan has been pumping water continuously into the crippled nuclear plant since the tsunami knocked out the system that was supposed to keep the reactor cores from overheating. The result is that there's now enough radioactive water there to fill something like 40 Olympic swimming pools.
You have this large amount of contaminated water, which is a good thing.
Yes, Per Peterson, chair of nuclear engineering at UC Berkeley, says it's a good thing to have all that water flooding the reactor buildings if you consider what could have happened instead.
Most of the radioactive material that was released from the damaged fuel was actually washed out into this water instead of going out into the environment, and that's good.
But it's also a huge problem when it comes to cleaning up the plant, because the radioactive water keeps workers at bay. So the Japanese utility hired several companies to build a water decontamination plant. They're hoping the plant will be fully operational later this week. The challenge is to remove radioactive cesium and other elements that are dissolved in the water. The water is being pumped from the flooded basements into holding tanks. From those tanks, it will go through a filtration system, something like a charcoal filter, that captures some of the radioactive material. Next, the water will run into a system built by the French nuclear company Areva. Spokesman Jared Adams explains that they use a chemical reaction to turn dissolved cesium into a solid material.
In our step of the process, the radioactive material precipitates out like rain and settles in the bottom of the tanks, where it forms a radioactive sludge, and that sludge can be removed from the tanks and then sent for long-term storage.
They use this process at other nuclear facilities, Adam says, and it works quite well.
We can reduce the radioactivity of the contaminated water by a factor of at least 1,000, so it will be significantly less radioactive than it was coming in.
Cleaning up all this water is likely to take a couple of months. If the water is clean enough, Japanese officials could decide to dump some of it into the ocean. But in the short term, they plan to run it back into the plant. That will keep the cores relatively cool. And as long as they stay cool, they won't ooze more radioactive cesium into the water.
I think this is an important step forward, because once they begin treating this water, then they'll be able to get into the plant and start doing significant repairs.
And one of the most important repair jobs will be to stop the reactor vessels from leaking water. Those leaks mean the utility has to keep pumping more and more water into the reactors to keep them cool. Per Peterson from Berkeley says several ideas are in play to plug the leaks.
One of the ones has been suggested is to literally fill the space between that containment vessel and the building walls with cement or grout. It's possible that one might also be able, using robots, to get in and patch places where the leaks are occurring as well.
Once the leaks are patched, the utility can fill the three damaged reactor vessels completely with water without flooding the rest of the plant. That would not only keep the reactor cores cool, but water, clean water that is, works as an effective radiation shield. In fact, Peterson says a water shield proved to be key to cleaning up the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown in Pennsylvania back in 1979.
It was possible to remove the fuel because you could flood water up above the level of the fuel, provide shielding, and then workers could actually get in to manipulate damaged fuel and get it out.
Eventually, they'll need to do the same thing at Fukushima Daiichi, though, like Three Mile Island, the process is likely to take many years. Richard Harris, NPR News.
All week, we've been marking the upcoming recognition of fathers. Sunday is a big day for all dads and those who've been like a dad. Here at Tell Me More, we've broadcast essays by some of our contributors and guests of the program that reflect the joys and challenges of fatherhood. Today, we hear from Ben Elkin, an alternative energy developer, law school student, and single dad, caring for his 7-year-old son, Stash.
Everyone tells me what a great dad I am, and I appreciate it. I really do. And I say with all humility, they're right. One of the things that makes me a great dad is that my favorite thing to do in this world is be my son's father. Stash and I laugh and play and joke around. We make silly faces, childish games, and inappropriate noises. But we also say please and thank you, clear the dinner table, make the bed, do our homework, and talk about what it is to live righteously. I sometimes think about the Will Smith movie, The Pursuit of Happiness, the scene where he and his boy are spending their first night homeless in the train station. But instead of it being a trauma, it's an adventure. That is so only because the father chooses to lead and the son chooses to follow. The catch-22 of parenting. By setting clearly established and fair boundaries, upholding them lovingly and consistently, rewarding good behavior while calmly but sternly correcting bad, you create a playground for your child to become themselves, and they get to gleefully play in it. Kids are just as smart as adults. They just don't know what adults know. But they do know when they feel safe and loved, and when they do, their lives are better, and so is yours. Due to some difficult circumstances, which it seems so many of us are facing these days, I've spent much of the last 3 years being Stash's primary caregiver, while I work and go to law school, without any local support. People ask me all the time, how do you do it all? And honestly, I have no idea. Though parenting skills are very important, when kids are born, they are who they are, and you can only guide them into being themselves. I am only able to be the dad I am and make our lives work because of the person Stash is, and that is the greatest blessing in my life. I recently asked him what he liked most about being my son. He said he loves that I play with him and joke with him. I told him the reason I do is that it's my favorite thing to do in the world. And he said, I know, Daddy. It melted my heart.
That was Ben Elkin, an alternative energy developer, law school student, and single dad, reflecting on Father's Day. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bridget DeShagas, Arjun Hutchins, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Amitha Parashar, Amy Ta, Lena Moses-Schmidt, Ryan Brooks, Saran Yetbarik, and John Ketchum. Our program is edited by Corey Dade, Kyle McKinnon, and Lori Grant. Our directors are Monica Efstatieva and Emily Oxenschlager. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. Our technical director is Brian Jarbo, with help this week from Neil Tebolt. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment, with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The executive producer is Tashima Walker. Remember, to tell us more, you can always go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can also follow us on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More, NPR. I'm Allison Keyes. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. There'll be more talk tomorrow.
Opera has played a part in many films, and not only films that are actually about opera. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, is going to review two new DVD releases that involve opera. One is an Italian romantic and political melodrama, and the other is a Hollywood musical comedy. They couldn't be more different from each other, and Lloyd loves them both.
The Italian film director Luchino Visconti was also an opera director, most famously working with Maria Callas in some of her greatest roles. His version of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro was one of the most memorable and realistic opera productions I ever saw. His 1954 film Senso, finally on DVD, actually begins at the Opera House in Venice near the end of the Austrian occupation in the 1860s. It's the climax of Verdi's Il Trovatore. The famous tenor battle cry is here sung directly to the audience with brandished sword and is a cue to protest the occupation. Di quella pira lo rendo poco. Tutte le pire mal le abbanco. E mi spegnete la occhia tra poco. Col sangue nostro la spegnerò. Era già figlio prima. Italian actress Alida Valli, who's probably best known for her moving performance as Orson Welles' lover in The Third Man, plays an Italian countess sympathetic to the protest. Early in Senso, she says to a smug Austrian officer, played by the late Farley Granger, who's just had a nasty argument with Valli's revolutionary cousin, that she doesn't believe that people's lives should be operatic. But she's about to be overwhelmed by a passion for Granger that will lead her to betray her cousin and all the fighters for an independent and unified Italy. Visconti's mysteriously ambiguous title, Senso, means sense, as in the five senses, or sensation, sensuality, or even common sense. In other words, the Countess's life becomes like an opera. And opera itself becomes a metaphor for all intense human emotion. Visconti's painful and riveting film even ends with a mad scene. Almost the complete opposite of Senso, but even more directly about opera, is a featherweight MGM musical farce from 1946 called Two Sisters from Boston. It too is a period piece, taking place early in the 20th century. The late Catherine Grayson plays a young woman desperate to become an opera singer. she leaves her snobbish Boston family and, to pay for her singing lessons, gets a job in a seedy New York nightclub run by Jimmy Durante. Grayson's efforts to break into opera by sneaking on stage during a performance are hilarious. But the real star of the film is the great Danish Wagnerian tenor Laurits Melchior, who, after he retired from the opera stage, proved to be a delightful comic actor in Hollywood movies. This is his second one, and he plays an opera star upstaged and enraged by Grayson's clumsy onstage intrusions. He has a devoted pet terrier, Tristan, named after one of Melchior's greatest roles. The dog follows him everywhere, even into a recording studio. My favorite scene depicts an early recording session. Melchior is reluctantly recording the prize song from Wagner's Die Meistersinger. He sings into a horn while someone adjusts his volume by pulling him by the lapels closer to or pushing him further away from the horn. When Melchior stops, a bunch of violinists rush forward to play. I think this is Melchior's most magnificent singing on film.
Von Blüt und Duft geschwell die Luft, oh la la la, die Ersonnen, ein Garten lud mich ein, und unter einem Wunderbaum von Früchten reich behangen, zu schauen im selgen Liebestraum, was ich dem Lob verlangen, Erfüllung hinterhieß das schönste Weib. Eva im Paradies.
The punchline of the scene comes when the recording is played back. When little Tristan jumps onto the table and stares into the horn, someone exclaims, "His master's voice." Everything in the movie suddenly seems a setup for this recreation of the famous RCA Victor logo. I love the way Visconti takes opera seriously, and the way Hollywood doesn't. Together, these two films present something close to the full range of what opera can be.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed Visconti's Senso on Criterion and Two Sisters from Boston on demand from Warner Archives. We have some great news to end the show with. Our former producer, Monique Nazareth, has just given birth to Grayson Sebastio Cronin Nazareth. We send our congratulations to Monique and her husband, Patrick Cronin, and wish them all well. I'm Terry Gross.
Baby mine, don't you cry. Baby mine, dry your eyes. Rest your head close to my heart, never to part, baby of mine. Little one, when you play, don't you mind what they say. Let those eyes sparkle and shine.